Thank you for listening to CASDA EdCast, where we explore issues and ideas of K-12 education and speak with teachers and administrators about their experiences serving the needs of students in our region.
My name is Greg Weinlein. I started working with at-risk kids at Berkshire Farm for Boys right out of the University of Albany. And from there, I went to a suburban public school and more or less designed and implemented a full-blown alternative education program. And after I retired, I came to CASDA and did program reviews for city schools, consultant work for suburban schools with alternate programs, and facilitator roundtable for dropout prevention at CASDA.
I'm Mike Schell. I teach at Adirondack Academy. It's part of HFM BOCES. This is my third year.
So, Mike, you've been at the program you're working now for 3 years?
3 years, and yes.
Did you teach elsewhere before then?
Yes, I was kind of all over the place because when I graduated college in 2008 as a social studies teacher, so there were thousands of us out there entering the market at the exact same time with the exact same credential. So I ended up, I subbed for a couple of years, and then I taught, at the time was known as GED classes, and I taught GED classes for 3 years, and then I moved into, I taught sixth grade social studies and in-school suspension. I've taught a fifth grade classroom in a Catholic school. I have taught seventh and eighth grade in a charter school. I've kind of been all over the place and done a little bit of everything, but I've definitely kind of, I think, found my niche with alt ed.
Now, at the Adirondack Academy, yeah. Is there a GED component to the program?
There's not, no.
Most of the schools, public schools with alternative programs, they don't offer a GED program any longer. It's still a Regents track where they get the same diplomas as everyone else. There are not that many off-site alternate programs. There's really a couple different types of programs. There's off-site alternate program, like the City of Schenectady, Troy, Albany, the large city schools have off-site programs. But most of the other public schools try and come up with some configuration for an alternate program to work with at-risk kids within the school. Do your students stay with you this whole day, or do they go to mainstream classes or regular classes, or is that just the program there?
It's just the program there. So for HFM BOCES, we have our component districts who bus all of the students to us every day. So I mean, the lion's share of our students come from Amsterdam, Gloversville, and then kind of sprinkled in is, you know, Johnstown, Fort Plain, Canajoharie, Northville, Wells. So we have very, very diverse population who's all coming and meeting at our school because the population of Amsterdam is far different than that of Fort Plain. So it's a real interesting dynamic with the students that we get.
And do you have any say in terms of what type of students you want in the alternate program there?
I'd like to think that we do. Sometimes we get surprise kids. Most of the time there's, you know, a little, the home district will kind of give us a heads up of, we're sending this kid, and, you know, and all their paperwork, all their background. And sometimes we'll let them know we don't think they're the best fit for our school, and sometimes it doesn't matter if they show up the next day anyway.
Do you find most of the students come to you via the discipline system of the school?
Yes, vast majority. Yeah. There are a few who, you know, who say that the regular setting isn't right for them, the classes are too big, they feel lost in the shuffle. But the vast majority of them, it almost seemed like the other school was throwing them away. We can't deal with this kid anymore, you do something.
I know many of the public schools, they'll come up with a mission statement where they're looking to work and help the students. And, you know, I'm sure all programs mean to do that. But they try and avoid the program, the student who would just go there strictly because of discipline. But, you know, they admit at the round table, you know, that sometimes those kids are just sent there.
Yes.
There's really no other place in a public school to send them. Yep. Now, years ago in the 90s, like a suburban school would send often contract with BOCES, and the kids would do academic classes in the morning and then go to BOCES for a trade, or electronics, or food services, or anything. But so many of the schools have cut out that connection with BOCES in the suburban schools. And, you know, and then, and it, you know, that was a great loss from my perspective. But, and then in the first decade of this century, there were major budget cuts in schools, and we lost a lot of the business classes, foods classes, shop classes, so they're not even there. So these public schools that run their programs within the school, there really aren't that many academic choices for the kids for course credit and everything. They take the core courses. They may have accommodations. You know, there'll be a smaller alternate ed class, but then they have to go into the mainstream population to get the other course credits, and they're not always a class that they would want to take or desire to take. But saying that, because there's so many, I think there's only one BOCES program at the round table, and there's 22 other schools represented. You have a major advantage because those kids can still, what are some of the extra classes and the skills that they can learn?
Yeah, we're very fortunate. We share the building with the rest of the BOCES. So in 11th grade, a lot of our students, culinary classes, criminal justice, computer tech, automotive, cosmetology, environmental conservation, where they're actually learning how to, a lot of the machinery, the heavy, you know, the front end loaders, all that stuff. They're getting hands-on training, a lot of those, you know, vocational skills that will be very helpful to them in the future. So they're very fortunate that really any kid who's in 11th grade who wants to, they have that opportunity to go, and it's just right next door. And a lot of them are very successful. Very successful.
When I was still teaching, I had to send one of my students who needed another credit, and the three choices, one of the three choices he had was romantic poetry.
So, all right,
that's
an option. That's a valid option. Sure, it's as useful as learning how to cook, but yeah. Whatever.
But I think if you're in a school within a school at a public school, we tend to delude ourselves that all the kids, whether they come out of the mainstream or the alternate program within the school, all of those kids have to be college ready, and that's just a delusion.
Yeah. And well, I think part of the problem is the idea that college is a superior option to other options. It is a different option, but there are many, many equal options where college isn't the catch-all for, oh, everyone's got to go to college, everyone's got to go to college. It's not the best choice for everyone, and not to say that the other ones are inferior, they're just...
So do your students work with any of the general ed teachers? Are they strictly, like, in your program?
Only for Career and Tech Center. Other than that, because we are our own separate entity, so the way our school is set up, we're in teams. Yeah. So I'm on the 9th and 10th grade team. So we have a math teacher, a biology teacher, an English teacher, and then I do special ed and social studies. So it's really kind of, I think I like our setup. It's kind of cool. It's unique. We are given a list of kids and three rooms, and then we start. So we make our own schedule. We have a lot of freedom with curriculum choices and what we do. You know, again, everything's rooted, and especially for me as a global teacher, Regents Prep. So the other than making sure they're getting ready for the Regents, I really don't get dictated to what I should cover or how I should teach. I have a lot of freedom. It's very flexible. So if one day, you know, I have a social studies class, it's 40 minutes, but they're not done. I can go over. I have to talk to their teachers. Maybe I get 50 minutes, maybe I get an hour that day, and we try to make it up. So it's very helpful to have such an open schedule, and just kind of, we work with each other, we work in very close teams and partnerships, and it makes the whole program, to have that fluidity to it, it makes the day go by a lot easier without having to worry that you're up against this time limit, or, you know, oh, I need to cover this material by then. It's the flexibility with our student population, I think, is essential for the program to work well.
At the round table, the first session, just last week, one of the participants complained of the stigma that his students feel going to the alternate program in a public school. Mm-hmm. I think that's one of the major advantages of an off-site program, if you can you know, afford the kids the appropriate educational opportunities. But do your students feel any stigma being bused to the academy?
Definitely some, yes. Without, I mean, there's still, I think there's that label that's put on them by their, you know, some of their peers at their home schools, or even teachers or administrators at their home schools, that, oh, these kids, they have to go. You know, sometimes I've heard of my school being referred to as the asylum, or the prisoners at ADK, that they ship them off. And there definitely, there is, I think very unfairly, this stigma that, you know, who cares what they do at this school, just get them away from us. And I definitely can feel that from some schools more than others. Some schools are far more guilty of it than others in my relatively limited interaction with their faculty and administration.
Now, what is the connection once the kids are assigned or go, you know, enrolled in the academy? What is their connection to their mainstream school?
They still can play sports. They can still participate.
So that's where we hear things.
Definitely. I mean, any given day, you'll see half a dozen different sports jerseys represented from different kids in their different schools who participate.
Yeah, I mean, the stigma is a big issue, and I think it's even an issue for people that work within that program, mm-hmm. you know, that you're maybe not as qualified as a mm-hmm. teacher because you're working at the academy. So the professionals can feel that stigma as much as the students. And I think there's many ways that we have to work around that to promote the success of our programs and to...
I've definitely had angry students tell me, well, you're not a real teacher anyway. You couldn't get a job at a real school. So definitely.
But I'll tell you, when you make that connection with a student, I mean, it's so much more intense and so much more real than, you know, getting a student to get 100 on a test that you hand out.
I mean, that is, at the end of the day, that is the most important thing that we do, is make connections with students. That on any given day, the most important thing I do might not be, you know, a lesson about the French Revolution, but it's the walk to go get a coffee and talk about the problems. And that has definitely been the most challenging and rewarding part of the job, is developing those connections and seeing how it pays off in the long run.
When, as the director of suburban school program, when I was involved in interview teams, I made sure the candidate who was applying for the job, I would say, and try and get a sense of if they really believed in this statement, I'd say, you have to realize that education is often secondary in your daily activities in the classroom. And, you know, you could sense right away whether, you know, they're immediately worrying about, oh, my God, the region scores or something like that. So it's so important. It is so important. But it's a shame, the stigma. I know a lot of schools are trying to, we're trying to get rid of the name alternative. We're trying to get rid of the label at risk. There's a few schools that have, the one right here in East Greenbush, Columbia's alternate program, and it's referred to as CAP. And to get rid of that, you know, when I mentioned, and that's actually the program I implemented at the high school. But when I mentioned that there's a trend to move away from calling the programs alternative, and they said, well, what are we going to call it? We got our T-shirts made up with CAP on it. We got all of our T-shirts. I said, change the A to achievement, Columbia's achievement.
T-shirts are still good.
It's still got a more positive connotation. And then, you know, then other schools are coming up with... not uniforms, but shirts. I know Troy gives out a hooded sweatshirt and a T-shirt in their program. We used T-shirts at Columbia as success stories when the kids did certain things. And Albany City School has a nice sweatshirt, Tony Clement Academy. But that used to be called Albany's Alternative Program, and now it's the Tony Clement Academy. But I think things like that, where you get rid of those labels,
we're just trying to change the outside perception, to shift it a little bit, just because when you take that laser focus of it's an alternative school, you take that off, it kind of changes the way people will talk about it or think about it.
Yeah, and I think often the faculty at the mainstream schools do disservice to the kids. Mm-hmm. Oh. Like in a regular public school, you know, they'll have a teacher in a mainstream class that they have to take for credit, say, oh, you're up in that program, or do you ever work up there? Do you do anything? Yeah, do they do the test for you?
I've heard it's glorified recess is what I've heard other teachers in other schools refer.
And the irony is
they've never been to my school nor seen what we do or how hard anyone works, but it's, again, that perception that it's glorified recess. It must be a zoo over there, so you know, you must not have these skills. You might not know how to do anything because of the perception of coming from alternatives.
And the irony being, if you ever decided you didn't want a kid in your program and sent them back to that teacher's classroom, well, hell would break loose.
Yeah, they know you're terrible. I don't want that, but you can't be doing anything right.
How do you, like, if we accept, and most people associated with at-risk students or alternate programs, they accept the whole college readiness thing as being something that's not, it's not really in their future. You know, around here we have many students who start Hudson Valley, but they won't even finish the mm-hmm. first year. So what do you, what does your staff or your program look for as a success story? I mean, it's easy to say we got them through high school, but we struggle at our round table, like what happens to kids after that. And then we do hear more sad stories than success stories.
Yes. It's, I've only been there long enough to really see the kids just out of high school, but the kids who seem, I would say, the success stories are the ones who are kind of trending in the positive direction of their making better life decisions. Even if they're, if we're not talking about success in financial terms, maybe they don't have the best job, or they don't have, you know, they're not necessarily totally independent, but they seem to be putting themselves in better positions for future success and continuing a lot of the trends that we're trying to set real early. And that's kind of what, you know, I've talked about with coworkers, is that we do a lot of the early, the groundwork. We don't necessarily get to see the payoff, because a lot, you're hoping that some of those lessons that you go over, and, you know, the life lessons and the talking through problems and talking through decision making, you're hoping that maybe it's 5 years from now that something clicks and you lose touch with that kid and you don't know. So a lot of them, they who knows where they go, and you're just kind of hoping that they're making better decisions about how they react. Just because someone disrespects them, they don't have to react so, you know, in such a volatile way, and to think through their emotions, and even to recognize their emotions and know what they're feeling and why. Little things like that would be a success story for some kids.
Here, I live in a community where I spent like 35 years of my career. And I was telling the participants at the round table, I had three success stories surface in June. And it was just a vision driving by my house. And I saw three of my former students were East Greenbush School bus drivers. And they kept it together. I mean, what you want them to keep it together.
Yeah, because, I mean, to hold a job, especially for a school district, there are a lot of, If you know they're employed, there are a lot of basic life functions you know that they're continuing, so that is definitely successful.
And then there's the sad stories, the kids that, you know, we talk often in the at the round table about, you know, it's such a fine line between helping the students and being a crutch for the students. Mm-hmm. And if you're too much a crutch, once you're not there anymore, what happens to them? And those are the sad stories that we hear.
Yeah, there are definitely times when you see on the news, you see a mugshot or a story, and it kind of gets you, because you feel like, I thought they were making progress, I thought they were doing well. Yeah. And even if it was, you know, maybe they're doing well 90% of the time, but one mistake, the wrong place, the wrong time, is a full life setback.
Yeah, and just last year, I went to three funerals of former students.
I mean, we have kids that are in prison or awaiting trial for violent crimes just in the past year or so.
It's I don't know what the answer is, but I think, you know, I think you could function in a program like this as an adult and just say, I got them through high school, mm-hmm. but we know that's only just the first or second rung on the ladder, and, you know, it's just natural that we worry about where they go from there.
No, and it all comes back to being the academics are secondary. Yeah. So that's an academic, you know, achievement to, oh, you graduated high school, but all of those other things that I spend so much time on, I want to make sure that those are the things that they're continuing to carry through with them.
Now, does the academy work with with the court system at all? Are the kids that come there on pins?
Yeah. We have probation officers in our building quite frequently. My principal, he shows up to court cases, and you know, pins are in probation. Various different reasons he's in court, in the court all the time.
I was the same way. I tell you, it does help with attendance. Have a judge say you best be in school.
Yeah, I know. Sometimes you can tell when you had a trial recently because you've been here 3 days up until November, and then you're here every single day after. You can tell when something changes or something else is compelling them to improve their attendance.
And I think those are the community resources that don't cost the school anything, and we have to make sure we bring them into the school, include them more, and make them part of what goes on in our programs.
Yeah, we have family counselors and all. I mean, there's just a rotating cast of characters who are always in the building who are attached to our students. And
well, don't say too much, because the public schools here will be very envious. Now, what about, the interesting thing is you don't have to deal with the general ed population, right?
Correct.
In terms of curriculum or?
Right. So I designed my curriculum around the alt ed kids. So it's very focused on, you know, the things that show up on the regions most often. It's, you know, I don't want to say teaching to the test, but if the major hurdle for these kids at the end of the year is this Regents, I think I'd be doing a disservice if I didn't spend most of my time focusing on the Regents and Regents prep skills. But we also, we've had a lot of training. We try to do project-based learning. So I'm trying to juggle, you know, I want it to be fun, I want it to be engaging, I want it to be interesting, but also they need, you know, for social studies, some of it's just memorization of content knowledge, some of it is just basic essay writing skills. So it's kind of this constant juggling act of keeping them engaged, but making sure it's academically rigorous enough where they're passing the test, but making sure they're still understanding it, because it's the content it can be so dense at times. So it's trying to keep all of those things in balance at once.
Now, have you seen, like you haven't been at the Academy for that long, but have you seen the whole approach to alternative education change at all?
Not in the time, because the way we've done things with, you know, my principal has been very exact since I've started there. He's had this vision, and this is the way we do things from the start. So I'm not sure, based on what he said, he's changed the way he does things over the course of his career by a lot. And but for the most part, it's all been focused on relationships. Okay. I guess the biggest change is this year we are pretty much trying to go away from suspensions. I mean, the idea that these kids got here because they've been suspended to death, that hasn't worked. I mean, if suspension worked for these kids, they'd still be in a general ed setting. So there's a summer training on TCIS, and we're trying, you know, restorative practices, and we're in the middle of this transition. And it's a struggle, it's hard, it's far different. But I believe that I think it will be going in the right direction. Yeah. And I think the idea of, instead of worrying about what happens after they do something wrong, preventing that thing from happening and developing that relationship where they're not going to do all the things that got them sent there in the first place, the harder you work on that relationship. So you kind of head off the problems at the front end instead of being reactionary at the back end. So we're still in the early part of the year where we're chipping away. But I fully believe that by March or April, we'll see a lot of improvement on, you know, the day-to-day issues.
Yeah, the suspension is a really, I don't want to say inappropriate, but you really need to avoid it with this type of student. Mm-hmm. You know, and you talk about labels for our students, whether it's at-risk or alternate ed student. The trending one is the disconnected student. Mm-hmm. And I think when you suspend a school, you're only enhancing that disconnection.
Because you're saying, oh yeah, you did something wrong in school, stay away from school. Where we want them inside. I mean, a lot of them, they have truancy issues to begin with, so we want them in school more. We want them to develop that positive relationship with school. So if you're sending the message, we don't want you here, it's so much harder for them to develop that positive connotation of coming to school.
And do you have any courses unique or specific to your program? Like I know in we had a life skills course, which evolved into a self-leadership course, and the kids could get credit for taking that in the program.
Nothing really like that on paper. You know, it's kind of the basics, the mantra we kind of have, and there's signs of everywhere, 22 and 5. 22, you know, credits, 5 regions. So the actual academic courses are your basic, you know, your main courses, and then the extra ones you kind of need to get those 22 credits.
Is like parent engagement, is that an issue?
Okay. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. It's, I mean, both in terms of just, I mean, when we have CSE meetings, it's very rare that we get anyone there. You know, even if you get a hold of them, there's a lot of times where, oh yeah, I'll be there. And then the time comes and there's no one to be found. And then a lot of times you know, when you do have meetings with parents, it's quite obvious where the children's behavior came from in the first place. And the parents are part of the problem. And I don't want, you know, there are definitely some parents who are really involved and try hard and just something's not quite working and they're frustrated. Yeah. But yes, getting parents to be involved and also buy into what we're doing can be a struggle. Because a lot of times you get them, you know, involved and engaged, but then it becomes, well, why are you going after my kid? Why, you know, what? My kid says you can't, that, you know, you did this and you did that. So it becomes almost a battle against the parent sometimes that you want to try to avoid.
It's interesting that I probably was 10 years into the program, going to 10 years of open houses and standing in the corridor next to the marketing teacher and the Spanish teacher and watching, you know, it looked like they were going to the Times Union Center, mm-hmm. the number of parents that would come into their classrooms, and I'd just be standing there all by myself. And then I finally realized that, you know, the parents of my kids feel the stigma too. Mm-hmm. And they don't want to come into the school and hear bad things about their kid. Mm-hmm. And they assume they'll hear bad things. So I, you know, I think it was about 2000, I got permission to do our open house separately, and we did it as a Saturday morning coffee hour. Mm-hmm. And out of 30 kids, we had 22 parents come in the first day. And
That's excellent.
In years previous, I would be by myself for the 2 hours open house. So I think, you know, if we assume that there's stigma issues with the parents, there's a sense of failure on the part mm-hmm. of the parents, and you just got to create the environment where they feel welcome. And they're needy too. I mean, that's mm-hmm. the trade-off is you end up trying to help the parents as much as you're trying to help the kids.
Because we don't actually have like an open house, but there's obviously constant kind of contact and trying to get parents to come in for meetings. And you can tell where there's a lot of times just like exasperation of, I don't know what to do. And it does become like almost like a counseling session of, well, you know, this is what I've seen and this is what has worked for me, so let's try to work together to help, you know, set this kid on the right path.
Now, the kids have like an academic counselor there?
Yes.
That does the other mm-hmm. types of counseling too? Mm-hmm. And then you have social workers?
We have a school psychologist. And then there's our school counselor, and then we have a school psychologist, and there are other family counseling, there's another family counseling counselor who comes a couple times a week to meet with kids, and then some of the kids have, you know, various appointments with different people.
I think the one most challenging, well, what I'm thinking in recent years is, I don't want to say a failure on my part, but I think somehow in our programs we're lacking in teaching the kids to be resilient. Mm-hmm. I mean, how do they cut it on their own? Because as soon as they walk out that door with their diploma, I mean, their next step, they'll fall down.
Right.
But at some point they need to pick themselves up. And I wish we were more successful in that, the whole concept of resiliency.
Right. I think a lot of what we're moving towards for us to kind of combat that is when the student has a problem or behavior, instead of telling them what they did wrong or what they should do different, let them talk it through and kind of encourage them to think through the process of what they did and how to better deal with it. So it's an intrinsic thing that's happening. So they're more likely, instead of just me telling you what to do, they're not going to listen to me. They're not going to remember that. But if you help bring them, if you help them get to come to those conclusions themselves, they're far more likely to hold on to that. So we're trying to just kind of, when there's a problem, you pull the kid aside and just talk and kind of pose questions that get them to kind of think through what happened, what they did, how they could do it different, and what, you know, what was I saying before, better process that emotion and their reaction to that emotion.
I know there's a national movement to bring the career and tech type programs back into the public schools and the mainstream schools. From your students signing on to those classes, what would you like say are the most important ones for like a public school to add back into their curriculum?
Based on just popularity of the students, the ones that who seem to join the program and stick with it, culinary, cosmetology are easily top two. Mm-hmm. And then I would say automotives up there as well. Those, if I had to break it down, like three that are the most popular and the kids seem to get the most out of that and stick with it, those are by far kind of head and shoulders above the rest.
Now we can cut this from the podcast, but when you said automotive, I had one of my bus driver students who's working on my second car, fixing it up over the weekend. And he was texting me everything he had to buy and texting me what he was going to do. And luckily, I'd hand my wife the phone because I really don't text him on Facebook. And so my wife said, this is crazy. I'll just text him back and I'll keep track of it. So the car's fixed and everything's fine. And so my wife sent him a thank you note. And the student, former student, wrote back and said, yeah, and tell Smoke Signals I said hello. So he realized, he accepts my remedial tech person lifestyle, I guess.
I mean, I'm sure you could get a good message across. Just things like get good arms. Yeah.
But those classes were so popular. And to have been in public education for so long and to see our students going to those classes within the mainstream building, where they were gifted, many of them were gifted in those classes. Mm-hmm. And then to just have them be wiped out, it's very sad. So I do hope it's cyclical and they come back.
It was right around when I graduated high school that I remember they started to move away from having them. You know, I graduated high school in 2004. And I went to Amsterdam, and those were the last couple of years that they had an auto tech program there. And then everything moved to BOCES.
So last night we put out a Twitter post to try to solicit some questions here, and we got a couple of really good ones, and we'd like to get your perspective on these. So the first one we have is, how do we distinguish between special ed and social emotional needs and alternative ed social and emotional needs? They can sometimes be very similar and hard to parse. Or is there like a distinction? You know,
I guess from my perspective, a lot of them, they do overlap, and if it's a special ed social emotional need coming from a disability, then you would handle it differently than even if it's a special ed kid who is having, you know, an emotional breakdown. You would want to come to the conclusion, like, what's the problem? What's caused this? And the first step, no matter what, would be de-escalation. I mean, no matter who the kid is or what the reason is, you want to bring them down so they can actually start thinking again. And then it would come down to, I mean, special ed, like, is it something that needs to be medicated, or is it something that they need to see a doctor about these needs, or is it something that they can just, you know, develop the skills to work through?
And I think the special ed accommodations come as a result of intake procedures, mm-hmm. you know, the testing and the counseling and the school psychologists. Well, I think a alt-ed student who is not special ed, you can look at like adverse childhood experiences, and you're usually trying to overcome those, the ACE characteristics with those students.
You think having teachers be more familiar with those ACEs, those sorts of rubrics and protocols, think that would be generally helpful for helping them to, you know, whether they're in a general ed building or even in an alternative or program, Do you think just having that vocabulary as a teacher would help them handle a specific situation?
I don't know about handling as much as just being sensitive to it. And I think that's huge.
I would say more than helpful. I would say necessary.
Yeah, I mean, right. they need to have that. But again, I have to admit, I was working with a classroom of 15 students, and I didn't care what the problem was, and I didn't care what I had to put on hold. And you take that teaching strategy with a teacher that has a honors English class of 30 to 35 students, and how much time are they going to have for that student?
But I just think, to especially with the ACEs, understanding the science behind it,
Really,
it changes the way you will react to the situation. If you understand that a lot of these kids, they're reacting because physiologically they can't help it, I think it'll help you have a more compassionate reaction.
Well, compassion, and especially not sending the kid out all the time.
De-escalating
the situation and, working with the student. And I think I don't have a definitive vision of this, but I look at all the conferences and workshops and that are offered at CASDA, and many, many of them, a good percentage, are for diverse learners and disconnected students, and we're sending out the need to be sensitive and aware of these issues, and I think that's very important for the teachers.
That's good. Thanks. So our next one here is kind of touches on something that you identified in your little historical timeline here. As more districts are bringing these programs in-house, so how can districts work to incorporate alternative ed students into district functions to have positive outcomes? Too often students are placed in an alt-ed program and are forgotten about it because it was a negative experience on both sides, presumably for the students and the district or the teachers in the district.
Well, I think, I don't think with school budgets the way they are now, I think very few students would begin an very few districts would start an alternate program with their own classes, and it'd be very expensive. I think many, many teachers and many administrators are looking to identify the at-risk students and find a way to work with them without a full-blown program. And maybe a full-blown program would evolve, after that identification period. I think, at the round table, there was, I met one woman, she's the at-risk counselor in her school. I introduced a concept that's very popular down in Virginia and Georgia called graduation coach. That really hasn't caught on here, but, you get a select population of students that are at risk of not graduating, and that one person works with them. There's variations of alternate programs that can be run with just one full-time faculty member. Because ultimately, I think you would agree, it's the contact time with the trusted adult that matters the most.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
So having one point person sort of establish a strong relationship is a good way for buildings and districts to sort of create those conditions relationships can happen.
Because if you propose a full-blown alternative education program, it's just too costly.
Right.
But I think because of all the trainings that are going on, I think students are realizing, no matter what, you can have the biggest alternate program in, a suburban school, and you are not even coming close to working with all the at-risk students in that building. So there needs to be someone there, and there needs to be a general population of teachers that are aware of these needs.
Yeah, and actually that kind of feeds into this next question here a little bit. It says, so what are some pre-alternative ed placement supports for students in need?
I think just go back to the ACEs training and really understanding when you have a student who's acting out, they're not just being a jerk, most likely. There's underlying issues, so if you understand what some of these behaviors could look like and what the reasons could be for them when you approach them, and always approach it with the mindset of de-escalation first. Because I think a lot of times teachers, they're used to being in control, so when something's out of their control, they react as a human would react when they're being ignored or not listened to or disrespected, and they have an equal emotional reaction. and that will just take a kid who's already in crisis and send them through the roof. So if you have this in mind when you approach that kid of de-escalation, because you want them to come back down and, you know, have significant training, and these are strategies that you should use to de-escalate, I think, and especially from earlier on, even in elementary school and younger middle school, you're not pushing those kids away from school so early, and you're not developing that negative relationship with school so early. So, I mean, I don't want to put myself out of a job, but then programs like this will be not as necessary because the teachers are doing the right things to begin with to make the strong connection to the student.
Yeah, and I don't worry about your job, because I think these programs will always need to exist, because a lot of times it's not an instant that causes a kid to like explode or disconnect. It's usually the baggage they bring in from the outside. What I mentioned to the participants at the round table is, when I started, without aging myself, it was more an out of sight, out of mind perspective on creating these programs. And as soon as a teacher was assigned to these programs, they wanted to get out as soon as an opening opened in the mainstream. And from even the round table, from meeting you, I'm just very, very happy that our kids have such sincere people to work with. Yeah.
Thank you very much. I mean, it's very rare that I actually get to, I don't interact with other alternative ed, you know, personnel outside of my coworkers. So it's very interesting to get a different perspective, different outlook on things.
Thank you, Mike.
Thank you.